I was also haunted by the thought of what might happen to us. It seemed literally impossible that this existence could go on much longer. We had been living in this way for over a year now, like gypsies, except that that is far too mild a comparison. Even the poorest, most wretched gypsies lived better than we did. For over a year one had been watching my comrades die. Suddenly, all the memories of that year came flooding back. The Don, the Third International, Aucheny, the battalions of stragglers, Ernst, Tempelhof, Berlin, Magdeburg, the horrors of Belgrade, the retreat, and only yesterday Henrik, his belly striped by a dozen streams of red blood, which ran down to his boots. What stroke of fortune had saved me from those giant explosions? So many men had already been consumed right in front of my horrified eyes that I wondered if what I had seen could possibly have been true. What miracle had preserved Hals, Lenson, the veteran, and the other survivors of our ill-fated unit? Although our luck had been almost incredible, and had spared us so far, it must almost surely run out, if this went on much longer. Tomorrow, perhaps the veteran, or Hals, or maybe even I would be buried. I suddenly felt terribly afraid. I looked out as far as I could see, in all directions. It would probably be my turn soon. I would be killed, just like that, and no one would even notice. We had all grown used to just about everything, and I would be missed only until the next fellow got it, wiping out the memory of preceding tragedies. As my panic rose, my hands began to tremble. I knew how terrible people looked when they were dead. I'd seen plenty of fellows fall face down in a sea of mud, and stay like that. The idea made me cold with horror. And my parents, I really should see them again. I couldn't just die like that. And Paula? My eyes filled with tears. Hals was looking at me, as still as that horrible landscape, indifferent to suffering, death, everything. There was nothing we could do about it. The screams of fear, the groans of the dying, the torrents of blood soaking into the ground like a vile sacrilege, nothing. Millions of men could suffer and weep and scream, and the war would go on, implacable and indifferent. We could only wait and hope, but hope for what? To escape dying face down in the mud? And the war? All it needed was an order from the authorities, and it would end an order, which the men would respect like a sacrament. And why? Because, after all, the men were only human. I went on crying, and muttering incoherently to my impassive companion. Hals, I said. We've got to get out of here. I'm afraid. Hals looked at me, and then at the horizon. Get out? Where to? Go to sleep, you're sick. I looked back at him with sudden hate. He too was part of this indifference and inertia. The tank near us fired a shell, and the Russians sent back about half a dozen, scattering the piles of rubble a little further. Maybe they knocked off a few more of our fellows too, the veteran, perhaps. Suddenly it all seemed unbearable. My trembling hands clutched my head as if they were trying to crush it, and I sank into total despair. My sobs attracted Hals's attention. He looked at me, almost in irritation. Go to sleep, for God's sake. You can't go on like that. What difference does it make to you whether I sleep or die? You don't give a damn, and nobody gives a damn. Nobody gives a damn about anything. And nobody will give a damn when you're killed, either. You're right. So what? So what? We've got to do something, for the love of God, and not just sit here in a stupor, the way you're doing now. Hals's listless eyes were without expression. His feeling of misery was probably as great as mine, but for the moment it was dulled, and his listlessness had overcome his outrage. Go to sleep, I tell you. You're sick. No. I was shouting now. I'd rather be killed and get it over with, right now. I jumped up, and left our hole. But before I had taken more than two steps, Hals had grabbed me by the belt and pulled me back. Let go, Hals, I shouted, louder than ever. Let go. Do you hear? You're going to shut up, for God's sake. And calm down. And be quick about it. Hals clenched his teeth, and clasped his two big hands around my neck, You know as well as I do we're all going to get it, one after the other. So let the hell go of me. What business is it of yours anyway? What difference does it make? The difference is that I need to see your face from time to time. The way I need to see the veteran, or that bastard Lindbergh. Do you hear? If you go on like his, I'll smash you on the head, just to keep you quiet. But if Ivan gets me, I'll be dead anyway, and you won't be able to do a thing about it. If that happens, I'll cry. The way I did when my little brother Ludovic died. But he died because he was sick. He didn't do it on purpose. And if Ivan gets you, you won't have done it on purpose. A violent shiver engulfed my whole body. Tears continued to pour down my cheeks, and I felt like kissing my poor friend's filthy face. Hals loosened his grip, and then let go. A burst of fire forced him to duck. He looked at me, and we both smiled. At the end of the day, our third attempt to move failed like the others. By this time, the piles of rubble which stretched out to the dark horizon seemed to have been leveled absolutely flat, with no protruding shapes, although a few chimneys were in fact still standing. Once again, the darkness was streaked with white lights, which glimmered back at me from the insensible retinas of my companion, and we began another interminable night of fear, in a dark hole, with a pool of cold water under the stones, and an exhaustion so heavy one wished to die, a night in which nothing or everything could happen. There were fires, and explosions, and short or long flashes of light, which killed the sleep pressing at the backs of our eyeballs. We listened to the cries of our fellow combatants, and the lethal rain of rockets crashing into the ground behind us. A thousand memories of my other life passed through my head. France, and my youth, still so close, and so remote, an act of childish naughtiness, a toy, a scolding, which now seems so gentle, my mother, and the new focus in my life, Paula. We hardly spoke during that night, but I knew that I should try to live for the sake of my friend. Long before daylight, a violent fit of shivering destroyed what was left of my resolution. In the grey daylight, Hals wrapped me in my cover, which I no longer had the will to unfasten. "Take this," he said, handing me a half-eaten can of food. "Eat it. You'll feel better." I looked despairingly at the jam mixed with lint and dust from the inside of the pack. "What is it? Eat it. It's good. You'll see." I did as I was told, and scooped out the jam with two fingers. But, before I'd swallowed even half of it, I was overwhelmed by nausea, and my vomit increased the filth of our refuge. "Damn it," Hals said. "You're much sicker than I thought. Try to sleep." Shaking with fever, I let myself fall into the mire, which I pushed back with my elbows and feet to try to make a flat place where I could stretch out and perhaps really sleep. Several hours passed before I regained consciousness. Later that morning, we were sent some reinforcements, and Hals was able to help me to another hole a little farther back, where two fellows put me on a makeshift bed laid across the shattered remnants of a ladder. Two other fellows were lying on boards which had been put directly onto the stones. Behind my head and my ears, ringing with fever, the war went on. I lay where I was, listening to its roar for an indefinable time, shaking with feverish chills, despite the pile of covers and coats which several well-meaning companions had thrown down on top of me. Once, somebody woke me up and made me swallow a pill. How much time went by? Perhaps a day. I fought my fever while Russians and Germans fought each other through the outskirts of the town. After turning the end of the enemy lines to the east of Konotop, we withdrew to the west, only to find a defensive wall which cut us off from our rear. Several attempts to move out to the west failed, and our autonomous group, already weakened, was faced with the prospect of entrapment in a Bolshevik noose, which was drawing tight, from the north, west, and south. While I lay shivering on my ladder, our situation grew extremely critical. Our staff officers were doing everything they could to kill the terrible rumor that we were encircled. The next night I was ordered to leave my ladder in a hurry, and tottered on my unsteady legs to a more secure shelter in a cellar, where about 50 sick or wounded men had been collected. I was almost turned away from this improvised infirmary, but as I looked pretty sick, an orderly stuck a thermometer in my mouth. When this registered nearly 104 degrees, I was told to sit in a corner, where I waited for morning and someone to look further into my case. Outside, the town was undergoing heavy bombardment simultaneously from the ground and from the air, and the orderlies were run off their feet by a flood of freshly wounded men. My comrades had gone back into the line, to face the increasingly ferocious enemy assaults. Toward noon, the orderlies filled me with quinine, and made me give my place to a fellow who was dripping with blood, and no longer able to stand on his feet. With stars dancing in front of my eyes, I staggered from the dark cellar into brilliant sunshine. A final burst of summery sunlit a landscape of total devastation. Everywhere, columns of smoke were climbing into the sky. Groups of slightly wounded men stood staring and talking, visibly stricken with desperation and horror. One of them told me we were surrounded. This terrible news was almost as destructive as the bombardment. A sense of every man for himself had begun to spread, and our officers needed all the severity they could muster to prevent a hopeless rout. Still another day passed, and I slowly began to recover, but my head swam, like the head of a convalescent who has gotten up too quickly. I stayed huddled in a corner as long as I could, gleaning fragments of news from the rest of the city. Surrounded. Dangerous situation. The Russians have already reached. We're trapped. The Luftwaffe is coming. But, instead of our planes, we heard yaks and its throbbing overhead in the pale blue sky, and torrents of Russian bombs shaking what was left of the town. What, exactly, was happening? Almost no one really knew. I can still remember a roll call, and then the non-coms coming to comb the infirmary. A fellow had to be missing a foot, at least, to be able to stay behind. I was among those who could still be used, and was led back with several bandaged companions to a zone near the front of the fighting. In a vast space bordered by roofless houses, a new group was hastily organized. Among the five or six officers present, I immediately recognized Herr Hauptmann Wesredow. From nearby, to the northeast, the thunder of Stalin's organs drowned our voices, and provoked a wave of panic which was difficult to control. I was still very sick. My mouth tasted sour, and I felt as if my thin, faltering body was supported only by my boots and my filthy clothes. Wesredow began to speak, raising his voice to make himself heard above the noise of the guns. He would probably have preferred to give us a more detailed explanation, but the continuous uproar, the pressure of time, and the risk of Russian planes suddenly diving at our three companies drawn up in the square forced him to be brief. Kameraden, we're surrounded. The entire division has been surrounded. We already knew it, but hearing it officially made us horribly afraid. A situation officially acknowledged to be dangerous by the staff must be very serious indeed. In the near distance, through the sound of explosions, we could hear the howl of Russian rockets. Both the earth and sky were filled with roaring noise, as if to emphasize the desperation of Captain Wesredow's announcement. We still have one hope, he went on, a swift and brutal breakthrough by all our forces pressing at a single point. This point must be to the west, and we shall engage all our units at once. The success of this attempt depends on the courage of every one of us. There will only be one attempt, and it must be successful. There are some strong infantry units which will be going into action to help us, on the other side of the Russian ring. If each one of us performs his duty, I feel confident that we shall break out of the Bolshevik noose. I know the qualities of the German soldier. Wesredow saluted and requested us to get ready. Our companies were directed to the points from which they were to press our final assault. There were many wounded men among us, more deserving of a warm bed than of further battles, and fellows like me, who were sick. The vast majority were utterly exhausted, staring with infinite weariness from glittering feverish eyes. These were the troops Wesredow had been exhorting to an excess of courage, valiant German soldiers who looked more like worn-out stock ready for the slaughterhouse. And yet we had to attack, or die. At that time, there was no question of captivity. As always, after a hard knock, we rediscovered a kind of unity, and seemed to be held together by tighter bonds. What provoked the sentiments of generosity which brought out the last cigarettes, or the chocolates so rare they were usually devoured in secret, a fraction at a time, inciting all the scum to fake friendship, leading the non-coms, who had probably been mixed up with every kind of dirt in civilian life, to pat a suspected possessor on the shoulder and talk of trust and faith, when they were really hinting for a bite, just like everyone else. Where did they come from, precisely when no one could use them? I was sick of the whole thing. My stomach was turning over and I felt cold. I looked for Hal's or some other friend, but couldn't see any familiar faces. They must all have been sent to a different position. For me, they had become almost like relatives, and their absence weighed on me. I felt very much alone among these mutilated men with their raging fevers, trying to find some excuse for hope and encouragement. I myself began to daydream about a soft bed with silk covers, imitating the veteran, who liked to dream aloud about beds like that, which he himself had never known. Even before the war, he'd been an unfortunate and unhappy man, but he knew how to dream. Sometimes, as his bony body lay stretched out on the hard ground, he smiled in a way which suggested such a powerful sense of well-being that I am sure, in those moments at least, he was unaware of the harshness of his situation, and that his dream was more powerful than reality. I myself was not yet that well-trained, and my dreams could not obliterate the feverish vice which gripped my temples. Straight ahead, to the west, the smoke had climbed so high it blotted out the sky, and the distant horizon was ringed with fire. What substance could be feeding such a huge conflagration? Companies of men black with dust and soot were pouring back, on the run. It seemed that our first contact with the Russians had not been in our favor. The retreating troops left a certain number of wounded with us, but no one knew what to do with them. The medical teams, which at best were inadequate, had already packed up and gone, or were about to leave. The wounded men were left lying in the street where they had been put down, trying to stanch the flood of their own blood, which was often pouring from several wounds at once. Everyone tried to help as much as possible, but we were capable only of ludicrous gestures. The most extraordinary scenes unfolded in front of our incredulous eyes. As we were sponging off a fellow who'd passed out, a fat Jeffreter came to help us, explaining that he'd just dropped a fellow with a smashed knee. He was making too much noise, and I couldn't stand it. Give me someone who's knocked out, any time. For the moment, our stretch of cleared street was not under bombardment. The battle was raging directly ahead, as well as to the northwest and southwest. Directly to the north, the Russian artillery was raking over the ruins like a monstrous plow. However, as a few of the retreating men huddled beside us trying to catch their breaths, the Russian fire shifted, and began to sweep through our position like a giant scythe. Our officers' orders were drowned by the shouts of the men, and the uproar of a frantic stampede for shelter. Our jostling and cries for help and screams of panic were finally obliterated by explosions. Everyone who was able to had run off the street. The slightest protuberance offered some hope of survival, as a wall of fire passed over the 2,000 troops concentrated on that spot. The wounded, abandoned in the open, lay writhing in the dust. Through the uproar, we could hear the sound of disarticulated bodies falling back to the ground in broken pieces. As at Belgrade, the earth shook, and everything trembled and grew dim, as the whole landscape suddenly became mobile. The filthy hands of ill and wounded men resigned to death scratched the ground for one last time, and the lined faces of veterans who believed they had already seen everything were transformed by desperate, imploring panic. Quite near us, behind a heap of tiles, a Russian shell scored a bull's eye, exploding in the midst of 11 men who had huddled together like children caught in a sudden rain. The Russian shell landed in the precise center of their trembling group, mixing flesh and bones and tiles in a torrent of blood. Chance, which continued to favor me, had driven me along with three companions to the shelter of a staircase in a roofless house. The building was hit on all sides during the bombardment, and the cellar filled with broken beams and other debris. However, thanks to our extraordinary helmets, our heads survived intact. When the thunder stopped for a moment and we heard the screams of the newly wounded, we looked outside. The horror of what we saw was so overwhelming that we fell back, as if paralyzed, onto the shaky stairs. "God help us," someone shouted. "There's nothing but blood. We've got to get away from here," screamed another voice, in a tone close to madness. He ran outside, and we followed him. The air was filled with bestial cries. Everyone who'd been lucky enough to survive was falling back to the west, where, as always, safety lay, and now the front, and the gap through which we would try to escape. Anyone who could still stand was helped. The wounded grabbed at the men running past. Two haggard soldiers in front of me were dragging a third man through the dust, probably a friend who was nearly dead. How long had they pulled him along like that, and how long would it take them to dump him? I can no longer tell how long our stampede lasted, through the anonymous ruins and thick smoke and roaring guns. The Russians were firing at us from all sides, at close range, with 50mm guns. We staggered on carrying the wounded as best we could. In complete disorder, we came to a railroad track strewn with the burnt-out wreckage of a train, and a few Russian corpses. We trampled over them with a kind of fierce delight, taking our revenge for their artillery and their 50mm fire. The tracks ran through a kind of drench. We galloped down it, passing a second train as still and broken as the first. Some of our vehicles seemed to be parked there too, surrounded by a crowd of soldiers and several Panzermänner. We ran right into a group of officers. Wesridow, who had stayed with us throughout, was one of them. We were given a few minutes' rest, and everyone dropped where he stood. To the southwest, the din seemed to have increased tenfold, and made my head swim. Then we received a fresh blow. Wesridow and two of his aides ran through the groups of exhausted men. "Get up. Get moving. We've got to push on now. The division has broken through. If you don't hurry, we'll be caught in the trap, so get the hell up. We're the last ones left." Already, men half dead with exhaustion were staggering to their feet. The non-coms tapped on the shoulders of the stronger men, who were trying to help the wounded comrades they had carried out of town, and told them not to bother anymore. "Don't load yourself with anyone who can't walk. You'll need all the strength you've got just to make it yourself." And so we were forced to abandon a great many men to an almost inconceivably horrible fate, despite their desperate pleas for help. Half paralyzed by terror and fear, men who had lost almost all their blood managed to get up and even hide their pain so that they would be allowed to walk beside the healthy. The heroism, pathos, and determination of our breakout exceeds by far my powers of description. Men who had always been cowards became heroes despite themselves. A great many managed to cover barely half the distance. We fought our way through the fires of hell, losing almost half of our remaining men, as we pushed for more than 9 hours, from shellhole to shellhole, along the famous and tragic Konotopkiev Road, past burnt-out tanks and piles of hundreds of shriveled corpses. You who perhaps will someday read these lines may also remember that one evening in the autumn of 1943 the bulletins announced that German troops caught in Konotop had managed to break out of a Russian trap. This was true. Of course, the price was never mentioned, because it didn't matter. For you, the day of deliverance was coming. Crossing the Dnieper, the rain blew in from the horizon in waves. Occasionally a brief moment of light enabled us to spot the next undulating curtain of water sweeping across the streaming steppe. It had rained steadily for 2 days, and despite the discomfort and inconvenience we hoped the rain would last for at least that long again. In another 2 days, if we could maintain our rate of 30 miles a day, and had any luck at all, we should reach the Dnieper. No planes could fly through such a torrential downpour. So there had been no yaks, and every day without yaks was a reprieve from death for hundreds of men. The extraordinary mobility of the Wehrmacht, one of its principal sources of strength up to that moment, had entirely disappeared in that part of Russia, and the men from Army Group Center were plodding toward the river in interminable columns at the rate of 3 miles an hour. Our mobility, which had always given us an advantage over the vast but slow Soviet formations, was now only a memory, and the disproportion of numbers made even flight a doubtful prospect. Moreover, the equipment of the Red Army was constantly improving, and we often found ourselves pitted against extremely mobile motorized regiments of fresh troops. To complete our disarray, the Soviet troops which had been tied up in the attempt to trap us at Konotop were now free to pursue our slow withdrawal. German aviation, which was entirely occupied south of Cherkasy, had abandoned our part of the sky to the Yaks, which took advantage of this freedom to harass us unmercifully. So, despite our heavy, waterlogged clothes, worn-out boots, fever, and the impossibility of lying down except on the soaking ground, we blessed fortune for sending us grey skies and rain. During the morning, 5 Bolshevik planes had appeared despite the weather. Our harassed men reacted with an automatic impulse of self-defense and self-preservation, staring desperately at the flat plain for somewhere to hide. But, like animals caught in a trap, we understood there was no way out. The companies in a direct line of fire dropped to one knee, in the regulation position for anti-aircraft defense. These companies received the Yaks' fire, and saw several men torn to pieces by Russian bullets, but nevertheless managed to bring down one of the planes. It was our bad luck that the plane went into a spin, and fell directly onto our convoy, crushing a truck full of wounded men, and opening a crater 20 yards wide filled with shattered flesh. No one cried out, in fact, almost no one looked. We simply picked up our burdens and went on. We were all too exhausted to react, and almost nothing stirred our emotions. We had all seen too much. In my sick and aching brain, life had lost its importance and meaning, and seemed of no more consequence than the power of motion one lends to a marionette, so that it can agitate for a few seconds. Of course, there was friendship, there were Hals and Paula, but immediately behind them was that hole full of guts, red, yellow, and foul-smelling, piles of guts, almost as large as the earth itself. Life could be snuffed out like that, in an instant, but the guts remained for a long time, stamped on the memory. We walked without stopping. The interminable line of men ahead curved in a semicircle which seemed to be standing still. The Dnieper was not yet in sight. We had planned to reach it in 5 days, but we were now in the sixth, plowing through the mud at an average speed of 2 or 2.5 miles an hour. I had never seen a countryside so huge and so empty. The trucks and other vehicles which had gas had all passed us long ago. The rest were pulled by the few half-starved nags we had not already killed and eaten. From time to time, someone gave up his place on a crowded shtina, pulled by 2 horses, to continue on foot. We were under orders not to abandon material for any reason whatever. We were supposed to receive more gasoline, God knows how, probably by air, so that we could continue to drive our machines. In fact, one morning we did receive a delivery from aircraft. 2 Ju-52s threw down 8 large packages of rope, which we retrieved with derision. We were supposed to use them for tying our vehicles to the tanks which had been destroyed at Konotop the week before. In default of gas, our gaunt horses stubbornly pulled our vehicles through the gluey muck which had been freshly trampled by 30 retreating regiments. Our shtina, on which I had hung all my gear, was pulled by 2 Rhenish horses, probably taken from their peacetime labor about a year before. One of them was covered with sores, and his eyes glittered with fever. 2 days later, on the bank of the Dnieper, our brave horse received his reward. A noncom from the cavalry shot him in the head, along with some 10 others. Very few horses were allowed onto the pontoons, whose capacity was inadequate even for the men, and nothing could be left behind which might be useful to the Russians. In a way, this was the beginning of our scorched earth policy. The proportion of sick men to healthy rose at an alarming rate. A healthy mind in a healthy body was the slogan our leaders had held up to us. Under the conditions of our retreat, it was often hard to tell which was affected first, mind or body. It seemed that well over half our men had nothing healthy about them,